administer the last rites of the church. And the minister was praying over her son, and the mother was crying. And the mother suddenly said to him, "I'm not going to let you do this. No matter what you have done, there must be still something good about you. And you're a young man, and you must have an opportunity to make up for the things that you've done." She said, "I'm going to the IRA, and I'm going to tell them to take you off this hunger fast." And she said, "I don't care what the IRA do to me, because I'm an old woman." And he heard her saying that, he knew that she and his family could be in grave danger. And he said, "No, mother, don't do it. It's better if I do it." He said, "Call in the prison guards." So they called in the guards, and the guards were told that he was going off the fast and he could be fed by a drip. And they set up all these drips and everything in action. And anyway, he was in this hospital for a couple of months. He regained his sight, he regained his weight, and then he went back into prison. He went back into his own cell, and they had fumigated it, they had repainted it, they had put in new furniture, because they smashed up all their furniture. He had new pajamas, and he had a shower. And he said he had the shower, and he put on these new pajamas, and he went into this new little cell, which was smelling nice and fresh from the paint. And he said he got down on his two knees in the cell, and he thanked God that he was alive. He said, "I thank you, dear God, for saving me. And I pray that you will take over my life and make something of it and help me to make up for the terrible, terrible things that I have done." He said that as he was praying, he remembered that when the hunger fast started, that they used to have Gideon Bibles in their cell, in a little locker. So he opened the locker, and there was a new Gideon Bible. And he just took it out and opened it up. And there he read, "Love your enemies, bless those that curse you." And he said to himself, "Have I been loving my enemies?" He said, "I haven't been doing that since I was a little child. I have been taught to hate Protestants." And he said, "I've been doing that all my life." He said, "Dear God, I don't know how to love them. How do you love them?" So he prayed that God would teach him how to love them. And he said that that night he had the best night's sleep he'd had in years. He slept like a baby. The next morning the prison guards came and they opened all the gates on his side of the prison along like this. And they were all the IRA terrorists, and they went out to have their breakfast. But he said the gates on the other side opened, and out came all the loyalist terrorists. And he said that every morning when this used to happen, he used to wish he had a gun, that he would just finish them off. But this morning he said, "Why, they're my brothers. And there must be something good in them." And he decided to go over and speak to a couple of them. He did that. He told them he didn't want a war with them anymore. And they put him in touch with this group called the Soldiers of the Cross. And they were these Christian prisoners. So he became very involved in this work. Now they were out and they were trying to help people not to get into these terrorist organizations. Well, as this young man was telling his story, he was sobbing. Sometimes he was crying so hard that you couldn't hear what he was saying. And I don't mind admitting that I was crying with him. I was on my two knees on my kitchen floor, praying that God would forgive me for the hard, hard thoughts that I was thinking when I wished that he would die. Because I suddenly realized that out there on that awful dark night was a mother praying for her son. When nobody else was wanting to pray for him, when everybody else was thinking how bad he was, and there was that mother praying for her son. And you know, a mother's love is next to God's love. There's no love like it. on this earth, because a mother can always see some good where others can only see bad. I was so grateful for that lesson, and that day I prayed, "Dear God, teach me to love. Show me how to love the way our Master loved." And then a Protestant minister came on to finish this program. And it was so interesting. He read from the story of Hosea. And he said that Hosea was a great prophet, one of the greatest prophets in the Bible. And this great prophet was married to a woman who became a prostitute. Hosea knew that the second child wasn't his, but he knew definitely that the third child couldn't have been. So after the third child was born, he sold her into slavery. He put her out. He couldn't tolerate it anymore. But he, being a prophet, began to realize that the same thing that was happening in his marriage was happening in his country, because the people in his country were following other gods. They had left God, their first love, and they were out following other gods. They were committing adultery and doing terrible things. And God told Hosea, and Hosea was the first prophet to learn that God is love. The other prophets taught that God was a hard God, but Hosea was the first one to learn that God is love. And it's interesting, because then that takes us into the New Testament, where we learn of God is love. And God told Hosea to go back and buy her out of slavery. And he went and bought her for 13 pieces of silver and a handful of barley. And he promised her, "I will betroth thee unto me forever." And this man spoke so much about the love of God, and that how we had to be like Hosea and forgive even these terrorists in our community. That was a tremendous help to me. Another healing I'd like to share with you was that of a loyalist terrorist. I told you I'd helped this man in prison who was healed of blindness and disease? Diabetes, that's right. Well, one night, some maybe 3 years or something after that man had had his healing, the Friday night, I was getting ready to go to bed, and the phone went. And it was a young woman, and she was crying, and she said, "Could you help my husband, because he's dying of cancer?" And she said, "He's only 40, and we've got 5 children, and there's absolutely no hope. He's only been given a few days to live." And I said, "Well, how did you know about me?" And she said, "My husband was in prison when you helped another man, and my husband saw that healing." So she told me what hospital he was in, and I said, "Well, I'll go up and see him tomorrow." Now, because I hadn't seen the man, and I wanted to see him, and I didn't really want to treat him, the only thing I did was pray to know that the whole word belief in cancer was a lie. People fear the name of cancer. It doesn't matter what name it calls itself. Nothing ugly could ever grow on God's child or grow in it. Because the Bible says, "I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it." And nothing needs to be added to or taken from God's child. God's child is perfect. So I prayed to know that the world could not be hypnotized, terrorized, frightened by the belief of this condition. The next day, I went up to see this young man. He was in the bed, and he had all these tubes right all the way down. And he said to me, "What did you do last night?" He said, "Because my wife phoned you from the hospital." He said, "They had given me all this morphine. It didn't kill the pain. And I was screaming that God would take my life away. But," he said, "when my wife came back from the telephone, I didn't have any more pain." And I said, well, that was wonderful. And this man said, well, now, before you say anything to me, I want to tell you about me. He said, I've never read the Bible in my life. I've never been in a church or a Sunday school. I am a war dog. He said, I train loyalist terrorists to kill Roman Catholics. I know all about guns. I know all about ammunition. I've read every book on the subject. I can make bombs. I can do all these things. He said, I want you to know that about me. But I want you to know something else. That if God heals me, I'll become a soldier for Christ. And I'll be the best soldier in his army. When he said that to me, I remember seeing his innocence so clearly, that he was a victim of the society that he was brought up in, that this was really no part of this man. And I felt, like it says in the New Testament, that Jesus felt that virtue had gone out of him. And I stood there motionless. In all my years of practice, I never had as moving an experience. I felt like virtue had gone out of me. And this man suddenly looked at me and said, what have you done? He said, I feel like you washed me all inside and I'm all clean. And I was so moved that I had to go outside. I had to excuse myself. I stood out there. I felt I was in the presence of God. And I had a bit of a weep and I came back, and this man said to me, I know you've done something to me. And I said to him, you know, you remind me of Saul of Tarsus, because Saul of Tarsus was a bad man and he murdered Christians. But when he saw the light, he worked for God. And he said, who is this Saul? Who is he? Tell me about him. And I got out my Bible and I read the story about Saul and how he was changed into Paul. And the man said, would you give me that Bible? Oh, I'm going to be like him. I'll be a changed man. So anyhow, in came the man's wife, and he had like a minister from some church with him. And the man who'd been healed got very excited, and he said to her, oh, this is Mrs. Smith, and this most wonderful thing has happened to me. And I looked at this minister, and sort of shudders came down in his face. So I decided to go home. And I said to the man, I'll come back and see you tomorrow. I came back to the hospital tomorrow. He had been moved into another ward. And when I went up, his bed was empty. And this young man beside him said, are you looking for, his name was Derek. And I said, yes. He said he kept us awake all night. He said he stood up in the bed and he pulled out all the tubes. And he shouted, I'm healed, I'm healed, I'm healed. And he said all the nurses came out and they thought he'd gone bananas. They thought the pain had gone to his head. And what a job he had. He said he's in there having a bath and shaving. He's leapt over every bed. He's jumped over every bed this morning. And out came this man, Derek, and she said he was 40, but honestly he looked such a young, young man. And he'd shaven and he'd danced me round the ward and kissed me and said, I'm healed, I'm healed, I'm healed. So then his wife came back and I said, well, I'll go. And I said, no, I don't know what's going to happen here, Derek, but you have my phone number and you can call me. Well, 6 weeks went by and I never heard a thing. Not a thing. Well, I began to think that I had dreamed it all. And then a member of our church who worked in an old people's home, it called me one day and she said she'd been on the night shift the previous night and she was having tea with the nurses and they were talking about faith healing. And the nurses said they didn't believe in that at all. And one nurse said, well, I do, because a man who lives next door to us who was a terrorist for years was healed by a woman named Mrs. Smith and told the name of the road that I lived on. And he's healed. And she said, he's in our church, the church opposite us, every night. He's giving a testimony. And the church is full. and the tapes of his testimony have been sent to America and Canada and everywhere. Well, I thought that was a bit strange. He didn't come to our church or, you know, come to say thanks to me. Anyway, about 6 weeks after that, I had a call from Miss Derrick, and I said, well, I'm surprised hearing from you. He said, I just wanted to tell you that I've been to the hospital. They sent for me and said I needed chemotherapy. And he said, when I went there, they did all these x-rays and said, we don't know what's happened to you, but go back to your work. You're healed. There's no cancer in you. So he said, I wanted you to know that. And I said, well, you know, why did you never come and see me or come to my church? He says, because I can't understand your church or those books that you gave me, but I can understand the church that I'm going to. He said, you know what I did? I went and burnt down this hall where the terrorists met. He said, I burnt it to the ground, and five of those men have become Christians, and I've become a preacher in the church. And he's reading and studying the Bible and was taking a course on it. Wasn't that an amazing thing, the power of God's love at work in that man? And he was only in the hospital and simply saw this thing happen, in the prison, and saw this happen to somebody else. But something in there clicked. Something rang a bell. That's why we should be doing a lot more in our prisons. We should be getting literature in there. We don't know who it will help. But I know personally I've had wonderful experiences in the prison. Am I talking too long? No? Okay. Well, I wanted to share with you another story, because sometimes we get our timing all wrong. We think we give somebody a textbook, or we give them some sentinels, and we never get a response. And we think, you know, oh, well, what's the use? They're not ready for it, or should I bother? And sometimes it even puts us off giving it to somebody else. Well, I had an experience in Northern Ireland many years ago. And I was quite a new Christian Scientist, and my children were very young. And we lived in a brand new house, so there were lots of children around and young couples. There was a young couple lived right opposite our house, and we had very big windows. And this young woman, she loved to go to parties and she loved to drink and so forth. And any time we went to a coffee morning or something in somebody else's house, she was always asking me questions about my religion. And honestly, I didn't want to tell her. I thought, there's no way she's interested, or she's just being a nuisance. I used to try to avoid her. But she didn't have a telephone, and she used to come to my house to use my telephone. And she would call long distance, London, and leave me about 10 cents, you know, and bring her two kids for me to look after while she was on the phone. So I thought she was really a bit of a pest and a nuisance, and I tried to avoid her. And I didn't think she was ready for Christian Science. Anyway, one day we were having a meeting in our church. There was a man called Mr. White who went round all the churches. I don't know if he came in America, but he came to Ireland for 3 days, and we had all these seminars, these talks. So we had been asked to work for the meeting. This was the day before the meeting, and when I got the children out of school, I was sitting there praying, and the doorbell went, and it was a wet, wet day. And this young woman was standing there, and she had her little daughter in her arms, all wrapped up in a blanket. Now, I knew to look at the child that the child was in a fever. She was burning hot, and she was sleeping, and her mother was crying. And she said, Myrtle, can I come in? So I said, okay. And she came in. We put the child down on the settee. And she said, Myrtle, do you remember I told you that my mother had, after her family were grown, she had two children very late in life, and they were both born with club feet, and they both had to have a steel up their leg and a surgical boot made. And she said, my one dread was that this was inherited and it could happen to my children. well, she says it has happened to Andrea. And this little girl was the most beautiful little girl, and she was only 2 and a half, and she said it has happened to her. She said, I took her to the doctor who sent her to the hospital, and the hospital put a cast on her leg, and they said, we'll keep it on for 6 weeks, and when the cast comes off, if her ankle is still turned in, she's going to have an operation on her foot to put a hole through it, and she will always have to wear a surgical boot. And she'd been to the hospital that morning, and they had taken off this thing, and her foot was worse. Was all twisted in, and she showed me the little deformed leg. So she said, what am I going to do? Well, I was at a loss for words, and I said, well, I don't know, what do you want to do? You go to medical. She said, yes, but what would you do? And I said, well, I'm a Christian Scientist. And she said, I know that. What would you do? And I said, well, I would take her to a practitioner. She said, well, what would the practitioner do? And I said, the practitioner would pray for her. How would she pray for her? Would she lay hands on her? I said, no, the practitioner would know that that child was really God's child, that she wasn't your child at all, and that everything that she had inherited, she has inherited from her father, mother, God. Well, everything I said, she would say, well, I believe that. I've always believed that. Is that Christian Science? It's no big deal. I believe that. So then she said, what would you do? And I said, I would support the practitioner. And how would you pray? And I told her that too, that I would see she wasn't my child and that I didn't have any responsibility. And she said, well, it's no big deal. I believe that. That makes sense. That's common sense. Everything I said. So she was there about an hour and a half, and I looked at the clock, and I said, listen, I've work to do. My kids will be home, and I have to make the dinner. And she said, so have I. She lifted the child, who was still asleep. She ran out. And this is honest. I never treated that case. I never even thought about it. I simply thought, I have to get on with this dinner. And it went out of my mind like it had never happened. Then came the 3 days when we were at church. We went to church, it was 3 days, and had these wonderful meetings. And about a week later, I was in the grocery store, and this young woman was there with Andrea. And she called me and she said, I've been trying to find you for about a week, and you've never been in. She said, look at Andrea. And I looked down and said, oh, she got a new dress. That's a pretty dress. And she said, no, look at her feet. And I said, oh, she's got lovely red shoes. They're nice shoes. She said, no, look at her feet. And the penny dropped. And I said, my goodness, her foot, she's healed. She said, yes. I brought her home. She said, I put her in her cot, the way she was, even with her clothes. She slept until the next morning, climbed out of her cot, and running into her, Mommy, my leg's better. What a lesson that was to me. You know, should we decide who's ready for Christian Science or who's not? Well, she told the whole neighborhood about this healing. And anyway, shortly after that, she was having problems with her marriage. And I gave her the textbook and told her to read the chapter on marriage. But her husband, by this time, had got a job in South Africa. And she didn't want to go with him because she didn't think the marriage was going to work. But she witnessed a policeman being murdered in Northern Ireland. And she very courageously went to court and pointed out the person who had done it. And when she came out of the court, the policeman said to her, now you can't go home to your own house, not even for the night. He said, you'll have to go and stay with relatives or somewhere, and we advise you to get out of the country. Because these guys will find you no matter where you are. So the police went to her house and cleared everything out, and she decided to go to South Africa. Now, she was away 20 years. And I often wondered, did she ever go to church? Did she ever read the textbook? Did she ever? Anyhow, I was lecturing in South Africa 3 years ago, and I was addressing an association as well. And on a Sunday, one of the church members took my friend and I out for lunch, and we didn't know where to go. And we passed a zoo, and she said, well, maybe you'd like to see some of the animals, and there's a restaurant in here. And we went in, we were sitting, when I saw this young woman and another woman talking at a table. But she looked a little bit different now, but I hadn't seen her for 20 years. So my friend said, you know, what are you looking at? And I told him, and said, well, go up and ask her. So I went up to the table and asked her, are you this person? She looked astonished. And she said, yes, who are you? And then suddenly it dawned on her who it was. She said, Myrtle, sit down. She said, you know, you're not here by accident. She said, I'm going to tell you what happened. She said, Bobby and I did divorce in South Africa. She said, I've lived here all these years. She brought up her two children. She fell in love with another man, and she thought things were going great, and she came home one day to find him and her best friend in bed together. She went out in her car. She was so upset, she crashed the car, and she had a bad accident. She'd been in hospital for quite a while, but there was something the matter with her leg. And she said that 2 weeks before I arrived, she had a little poodle dog. And this poodle became very swollen. And she took it to the vet. And the vet said, well, it's very old. I'll give it an injection. It's swollen because it can't pass water. And if it can't pass water by the morning, you're going to have it put to sleep. She said she felt like her whole world was collapsing. That she loved this other man with such faith in him and her best friend. And now here she was losing her dog. So she rang another good friend in the middle of the night. It was 3 o'clock. And she was crying and she said to her friend, I've just been like my world's collapsing around me and I have to have my little dog put to sleep in the morning. And then she began to tell her friend about her daughter's healing in Ireland. And she said, if I could get that woman's telephone number, she said, this dog wouldn't need to be put to sleep. So the woman said, do you not remember her number? Could you not find it through the directory? And she said, no, she's moved away. The woman said, well, you mentioned a book that she gave you. Could you read the book? She said, no, I lent that book to someone and they never gave it back to me. So and then the woman said, can you remember anything that was in the book? So she said, well, it tells you that God is really a loving, caring God and that he makes man perfect and that he cares for his creation. He really cares for his creation. So her friend would say, everything she said, her friend would say, well, that means the dog. And she would say, yes, that means the dog too, and that means me. He's caring for us all. And she said, the dog went off her knee and moved up the settee and went to sleep. And she went off the phone and went to bed, sound asleep. The next morning, the little dog jumped into her bed, was licking her all over. She said when she got up, he had weed all over the place. But she was so glad to see it. And she said that she said to herself that it was time she found a church. She said, God has proven to me that he's been taking care of me, and what have I been doing for God? And she was wondering which church she could go to, and she said, now that you're here, I know. And she drove me 200 miles to meet this daughter, who was now married and had 3 children. And she, the daughter said that her mother told her many times over the years about her healing. The next week, her daughter and her husband went to the church nearest to them and enrolled her 3 children. And my friend went to the other church, and she took a week off work to read the textbook. And she called her boss. She said, I'm taking a week off work. You owe me some time. He said, are you sick? She said, no, I'm going to read the Christian Science textbook. And he said, you are sick. And she bought about 10 copies of this textbook and just gave them away to everybody. And this was so marvelous for me and for the people in the church that I realized something, that the first time she came to me was when all the members of our church were praying about something. And the second time she came was when all the members of the church in South Africa were praying about something. That it wasn't anything to do with me personally. So sometimes we think that our prayers are not having much proof of what they're doing. But there's always proof. And it's our sense of timing that makes us think that it's that it just isn't happening. I was thinking yesterday about the 23rd Psalm, and how much that has meant to me. So I would like to just end up with that. Because, you know, this is Mrs. Eddy's definition of it. She says, "Divine love is my shepherd." Now, a shepherd protects. A shepherd cares for. A shepherd guides. A shepherd goes and looks for the lost sheep. If divine love is our shepherd, what does that mean? It means that if we let love govern our thoughts, that becomes our shepherd. That will guide our thoughts and therefore our actions. Divine love is my shepherd. I shall not want. We never want if we let divine love become our shepherd. If we love instead of hate. If we refuse to get angry or uptight or be resentful and replace those thoughts with love. Nurse those qualities, the nice qualities. Now, here it tells you all the things that love does, and it says, love maketh me to lie down in green pastures, in new pastures of thought, that means. Love forces us to do that. Once we replace the anger, frustration, and everything with love, love maketh us lie down in green pastures, new pastures of thought, with me, beside the still waters. That love leads us beside the still waters of peace. When you're loving, you're really living. If you're not loving, you're not living. That love will lead us beside the still waters of peace. Love restoreth my soul, my spiritual sense. That's what love does for us, restores our spiritual sense. Love leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Leads us in the right path to make the right decisions, do the right things. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. This mortal experience is like the valley of the shadow of death. But a shadow can't hurt you. Shadow of a gun couldn't kill you, or the shadow of a knife. So the shadow of death can't even touch us if we love. Yea, though I walk through the valley, we can walk through it. We don't have to get dragged or pulled or pushed. Walk leisurely through the valley of the shadow of death. And it's only a shadow. I will fear no evil, for love is with me. Love is with you. That means it's always in your capability to love. You're always capable of loving. What am I saying? Oh, there are times when I just can't love. It's not that you can't, you won't. There's always, you can always love. Love is with me. Love's rod. Now, love is a rod because it makes us bend like the sheep. And we have to do what we didn't want to do. We wanted to be critical and we wanted to condemn. But love's rod said no. Love's rod, and then that becomes a staff on which to lean. When we've seen what love can do, that becomes a staff. Love's rod and love's staff they comfort me. Nothing comforts us like that. Love prepareth a table before me in the presence of my enemies. What are enemies? Is it people who are doing things that we don't like? It's wrong thinking. It's criticism. It's self-will. It's self-love. And the worst of one of all is self-justification. When we justify the error in our own thinking, these are our enemies. But love prepares a table of love and lovely thoughts in the presence, the very presence of where these enemies were. Love anointeth my head with oil. Anoints us with the ability to do this. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house, the consciousness of love, forever. That's where your house is, and my house is, and your church is, and my church is. It is in the consciousness of love. And we're not at home, we're not at ease, if we are not loving. I will dwell in the house, the consciousness of love, forever. And then, of course, there's the definition of Jesus, which we heard read today. And it tells us a type of spiritual peace flowing from the understanding that God is the divine principle of all existence, and that man is his idea, the child of his care. Now that's who you are, and that's who I am, and that's who all that your thoughts rest upon are. That's to everyone in Great Falls and Montana and America and the world is, whether they know it or not, that is the truth. Man is the loved of love, and our God is love, and he's loving us all right now. We're just embraced in this love. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the power of Thanksgiving, because I know Thanksgiving's coming up in Canada soon and then in America. Well, I used to think when I was young and I was not a Christian Scientist that Thanksgiving was just a nice, polite thing to do. But I used to think that God was very vain, because there's so many psalms and sing praise to the Lord and give him thanks, and to say to myself, what sort of a God is this? He needs all this affection and praise all the time, when we ourselves wouldn't want all that much. But I have come to see that God wants us to praise him and give thanks for our sake. Because when you give thanks, you put a power to work. Gratitude and thanksgiving is a power. And when you give thanks, even if it's only for a waitress or someone in a store, if you give thanks and really mean that thanks, that other person is gone. You put a power into work, into action. And one time, I think in one of my tapes, the one with the Lord's Prayer, I speak about the healing of a young woman who was very ill for 7 years. And I had to bring her to my home, and while she was there, she said to me one day, why is my healing so slow? If God is going to heal me, you know, why doesn't he get on with it and do it? And I said to her, well, we have to give thanks for the little bit of progress that we've seen so far. And I said to her, you know, Thanksgiving really is a great power, and I told her about times in my life when I was really down and had nothing, and sometimes not even food, that I would magnify God by giving thanks, and that my need was always met abundantly. And I had to go downstairs to make some calls, and I left her some old sentinels. And when I came back, she was very excited, and she said, I found this article in a sentinel, and it was by Peter Henniger Heaton. And I think it was 1970 or something. The article was entitled Gratitude, Not Grievance. And it was talking about the power of gratitude. But in it, he said that this, he said, in all the great cities of the world, they have a square, like Times Square, New York, Trafalgar Square, London. He said, but this year in Dallas, in Texas, they're opening a square called Thanksgiving Square. He said, this is a square where people from all walks of life can go and give thanks to whatever God that they believe in. And he said that this was a wonderful thing. And he ended his article by saying, even if you don't have a Thanksgiving square in your city, could you open a Thanksgiving square in your heart? So my friend and I decided we would open a Thanksgiving square in our hearts. And we both made out big lists of all the things that we were thankful for. Well, you know, that speeded up her healing. Believe me, that when her husband came home in 5 days, she ran down my steps to meet him. But I was thinking in bed one night while she was still there, if gratitude can do that much for a person, what couldn't it do for a city or a country? So I said to her, wouldn't it be nice if we could get a Thanksgiving square in Belfast? Because we certainly need something like that. Well, I was going to Boston 2 weeks later, and I went into the practitioner's office. The woman in charge was a Texan, and I said to her, have you ever heard of Thanksgiving Square in Dallas? She said, I know all about that. She said, the man who started that was brought up in our Sunday school, and his brother's a practitioner. And she said, why don't I call him? So she called this man named Peter Stewart, and he was so excited that I was interested that they invited me to come up to Texas, and they paid all my expenses. And I went there and saw this beautiful square, which has a waterfall and a garden, and the building is in the shape of a spiral, and up at the top they have this little chapel where people can give thanks. There's a big goldfish bowl, and you fill in a card with what you have to give thanks for and put them in, and then you can take some of these cards out and read them. It's a lovely idea. So I have been there several times, and I've given talks at it and so forth. And I've tried for 7 years to interest people in Northern Ireland to get a Thanksgiving square going there. I was on the radio, and I wrote letters to newspapers, but I got such little response. But I'm pleased to tell you that this year it's starting to take off, that the time seems to be right. It seems to be so timely with peace coming in our country that a group of businessmen have got together, and we're now trying to raise funds and so forth. You see the power of Thanksgiving. It brought about my friend's healing. It brought about much healing when I went to Texas. There was much healing. It brought about this whole experience of me going there and sharing this thing and bringing it back. The power of Thanksgiving at work is a wonderful, wonderful power. So we're not doing it to a vain God. God saw that we needed to do it. When you give thanks, you're magnifying the good. When you think you have nothing to be thankful for, you're magnifying the problem. So which are we going to do? Are we going to magnify the problem or magnify the Lord of hosts? Well, I hope that after all that we've shared today, that you're going to go home and magnify the Lord of hosts, and we will praise his name together and know that much fruitage will come from this meeting today. And thank you for the privilege of being here.